Honor, may it please the court. Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government, Megan Farley. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure. Let Mr. Your learned colleague over there get to settle there. Okay.
Your Honor, this is a straightforward case. The district court erred in suppressing the evidence, the gun that was recovered, as well as the drug paraphernalia.
Well, let me see, is that straightforward? You folks rely a lot on MIMS, obviously, right? And as I read MIMS, police can order somebody out of a car. But I don't read MIMS to say they can yank somebody out of a car. And what happened here was not an ordering somebody out of the car. They yanked them out of the car. So how do you reconcile what happened here with MIMS?
So I beg to differ, Your Honor. I think what happened here is the police did order him out of the car. They just did it physically instead of orally. What we're dealing with here is the manner in which he was taken out of the car. And what we know from numerous decisions of the Supreme Court is that where the manner of some error by the police is not but for cause of the recovery of the evidence, then the exclusionary rule does not apply. There may be other problems. The police officer may have other issues as a result of his or her conduct, but not the suppression of evidence. So there are so many cases that address this. Hudson versus Michigan, you have a violation of the knock and announce rule. They barge right in without giving notice. Supreme Court says that may be bad, it may not be bad, but the evidence that's recovered inside is admissible because it's going to be recovered anyway. Segura versus United States. The police go to an apartment without a warrant. They stay there for 19 hours inside the apartment until the warrant arrives. Supreme Court says that might be a problem, but we're not going to resolve that because it's not the but-for cause. The warrant was coming. You were going to find the evidence. Same thing here. If you look at the video, and I'm Your Honor's mayor, or I know you will, if you look at this video, you hear the testimony of Officer McConnell. He explains why they're going to take Mr. Christmas out of the car. If their perception is that Mr. Christmas is nervous, he's a little hysterical, he's getting out of the car, they don't know, does that mean he's simply going into the deli or does it mean he's up to something else? They, for their safety, as permitted by MIMS, are going to take him out of the car. And you can see that when Officer Rosenbaum walks up to him. Officer Rosenbaum.
That's where the disconnect I have is, you're saying pursuant to take him out, as opposed to ordering him out.
Well, let me use Your Honor's terminology. Let me simply say, he is going to get out of the car. And the way Officer Rosenbaum decides to handle it, and I'm not saying that he did anything wrong. I don't think it has to be resolved in this case. But if you look at the video, Mr. Christmas is told to put his hands up. And then the officer walks up with his own hands outstretched as he's reaching for Mr. Christmas's arms. It's very clear what's about to happen, which is that he's going to lay hands on him and he's going to guide him out of the car. And it's not yanking.
Can I just tease this out a little bit? Because we have the suppression hearing testimony of Officer Fred McConnell, and he says the order was to stay in the car, to get back in the car. And then we've got the video. And the video is, you know, we get our own perspective. We've got, I don't think you briefed, but, you know, in the qualified immunity context, we get this Scott v. Harris case, which kind of really, really, really colors what clear error review is like when we have a video seemingly making the threshold for clear error much lower when we have a video and the district judge looked at the video. I think it says courts of appeal judges can look at the video and kind of the same decision, and clear error is much less deferential in the presence of a video. That's how I take Scott v. Harris. So are you basically telling us although you didn't advocate it for in the brief, that we should kind of Scott v. Harris our approach to this case and just focus on our de novo almost take on the video?
I am not saying that, Your Honor. I'm simply stating the facts, which I think are consistent with the findings of the district court as well. The two things did happen. When they went up to the car, they told him, sit there. And then Bob went up to him and took his arms and guided him up. Those aren't inconsistent. That is Officer Rosenbaum exerting control over the situation. He wants him to be there so he can approach him, and so he lays hands on him and guides him up. It's all one consistent action that happens very quickly, and not violently at all. The only struggle that takes place is once he's standing up and they move him, then there's a little bit of back and forth. But What Rosamond is doing is he's taking him out of the car, and he's doing it in a way that protects his safety and, as Officer Connell said, protects Mr. Christmas's safety. This is in everybody's interest to do this in a very calm and safe manner. But the main point I want to emphasize, and of course I welcome Your Honor's questions, but the main point I want to emphasize is that we're talking here about the manner in which he gets out of the car, and that's not what's dispositive in a suppression inquiry. The manner, whether he's yanked, to use the initial phrase that was used here, or whether he's taken or removed or what have you, doesn't matter, because under MIMS, these officers have clearly made the decision that during this traffic stop, Mr. Christmas is going to be outside the car, and that's completely permissible. And once he's outside the car, they're going to see the gun. It's indisputable that the gun is seen from outside the car. So, Judge Phipps, you're right. We could debate facts here and get into the clear error standard. I think you make a really interesting point that we may be entering a different era of clear error review now that we have body cams, police video. But I don't know that we get there. The only factual thing that has come up here is the defense has suggested that the district court made some kind of factual finding that you couldn't see the gun with the door only open to the extent that Mr. Christmas opened it and not all the way. The court actually didn't make that finding because this argument wasn't even made to the district court, so it just never came up. But even so, I think looking at the video, there's no question that even to the extent that Mr. Christmas opened the door, that door was open. And if they had simply said to him, please stand up and get out of the car, Officer McConnell then has the exact same view that he had once they physically removed him from the car.
I mean, you know, the problem I think with the video, one of the problems is that it sure seems like a lot of force is being used. You know, just for kind of, you know, kind of making a U-turn, then not making a U-turn, and then turning the corner and almost hitting another car, opening the door. Now, look, it's all erratic. It all might be careless. It might be reckless. I don't know, but it sure is a lot of force. I guess what I heard you say is we don't care about the aggregate amount of force that happened here. What we care about is whether there was a Fourth Amendment violation at the time that door swung fullest, widest open, because that's when things become in plain view. There could be a Fourth Amendment violation downstream after that. But for this plain view doctrine, if there's no Fourth Amendment violation at the moment that comes in plain sight, then we're all good. Is that what you're saying?
We're saying that if there's a Fourth Amendment violation, it has to be the but-for reason that the evidence is then found. So in Hudson, you have a Fourth Amendment.
Just stop me. But isn't the answer to my question then yes?
No.
Why wouldn't the answer to my question just be yes?
Maybe if you rephrase your question, I would understand it that way. What I'm understanding is that he can be removed from the car, and that's the but-for reason that the evidence is found. There is no Fourth Amendment violation in directing him out of the car. Whether there's a violation in the manner in which he's removed from the car, perhaps. I don't agree, actually, but perhaps. But that is not the but-for cause for the discovery, because whether violently or not violently, to use Your Honor's phrase, he is going to be out of that car, and being out of the car is not the result of a Fourth Amendment violation. It is permitted by Pennsylvania versus Mims. And then, you know, we veer back and forth here to go to the facts. Your Honor, I think, said somewhat violently. I respectfully don't agree with that, looking at the video. What I see in here, looking at the video, is a lot of tension in the air, which I understand. I mean, the Supreme Court has told us over and over, we all know it, the risk that officers face when they go up to a car and somebody they don't know, and the danger that poses and the bad things that often happen. And you can feel that tension. At some point in the video, there's some bystander they start to have an interaction with. You know, we don't know everything that's happening on the street when three officers get out on a street and perhaps are surrounded by others. So I'm not going to condemn at all what the officers did here. They are trying to maintain control of this situation. But even if they're wrong, even if he shouldn't have laid hands and instead have first said, please get out of the car, for Fourth Amendment purposes, the result is exactly the same. He's out of the car. They have the view of the gun.
Counselor, if the purpose of the exclusionary rule on some level is to deter misconduct. I understand your point about but for, but doesn't that bring back in the manner in which the officer got him to get out of the car? And doesn't your argument require us to believe a counterfactual that we can't really know the answer to?
Well, I honestly don't believe it's a counterfactual. I think that the officer's determination to remove him from the car, as Officer McConnell said, for their safety and for his safety, is very clear. I don't think it's a counterfactual at all. The only question is, could they lay hands on him to do it? As far as Your Honor's first question about the relationship of but-for and the deterrent effect, that's what the Supreme Court has addressed over and over again in Segura and Hudson and all these other cases, that even if there's a police error, even if you could get some beneficial result from sanctioning the police for that error, that the exclusionary rule is not always the way to do it. And the exclusionary rule only applies where it's a but-for cause that the evidence was found. Hudson goes on to explain that there are other remedies. There are civil remedies. There's police internal discipline. And even in unfortunate cases, there may be criminal liability, you know, based on how an officer acts. But the Supreme Court has drawn a clear line that even if there are these mistakes, that's not the deterrent focus of the exclusionary rule. The deterrent focus of the exclusionary rule is on excluding evidence that would not have been recovered but for the mistake.
So, you're really, really leaning into but-for causation. Obviously,
absolutely.
Right? Obviously. It's your lead argument here. But, it's kind of strange because in the prior argument, we had the government really, really championing plain error review. And you didn't really raise but-for in its fullest form in the district court. So aren't you now under the plain error standard? And you kind of see how that standard can do work in a lot of different ways.
Sure. Absolutely not, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. The district court's ruling, which has now been interpreted, we didn't think it was entirely clear when we saw it, but the defense now says, and we accept, the district court's ruling is that he was forcibly removed from the car, and that's what caused the sight of the gun. That argument was not made by the defense in the district court. You can read their pleading, you can read the transcript, it's not there. The argument that was made in the district court by the defendant was first and foremost that there was no reasonable suspicion for the stop, and then when it went past that, they said that even when he was taken out of the car, that McConnell couldn't see the gun until he leaned into the car. So it becomes a breaking the plane sort of case. And the district court said, no, that didn't happen. He saw it from outside the car. This argument was not presented. If it had been presented, we would have made the but-for argument. What we're doing here is we are responding to the opinion of the district court that raised this theory for the first time. The district court, they pluck a couple moments in the district court opinion where the district court said the door was open and therefore they could see it, and to say that, oh, the district court was addressing this argument. If you look at the exact citations at the moment in the district court opinion, it's to statements of the defense counsel that have nothing to do with this, that are still focused on the fact that there was no reasonable suspicion, which is what their main argument was. So, yes, of course we would be subject to plain error review, might even be subject to waiver if we hadn't made a suppression argument like this, but we had no opportunity to. We're responding to a district court opinion here. So my time's up. I'll welcome the chance to address rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Schweitzer.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Brett Schweitzer from the Federal Defenders here representing Mr. Christmas. Let me try to put to bed this forfeiture issue that Mr. Zalzmer was just speaking of at the end of his argument. The argument was, in fact, made below, and we know that because the district court, in his opinion, expressly cited the part of the record where defense counsel made this argument about not being able to see, about the pulling out of the car being unlawful and not being able to see the gun before that. So the district court mentions that this is the defense argument at Appendix 12, right? And it cites Appendix 82 where this argument is made. So this idea that this was not raised below is just incorrect. Now, other arguments were raised below as well. We're not pressing those here about whether there was reasonable suspicion of Rex driving and so forth. So setting that aside, what we're left with here is fact-finding clear error. This is a very narrow case. you know, Mr. Zalzmer says means the manner of executing, you know, the order to get out of the car doesn't matter. In many cases, he's right. That's why I'm not here arguing that the headlock that my client was put in somehow resulted in the discovery of the gun. But sometimes manner does matter. And that's when it is a but-for cause of the discovery of the evidence. And here we have a fact finding by the district judge that the removal was a but-for cause. And that is perfectly clear at Appendix 6, 13, and 18. I cite these in my brief. You know, the most obvious statement the district court made was the government hasn't established that the evidence McConnell hasn't established that McConnell could have seen the gun had Rosenblum not swung the door fully open. Didn't get any clearer than that. That's a fact finding by the district judge. The argument was made. And so what we have here on appeal is really just bucking fact finding at the end of the day. And Judge Phipps, to your point about the video and the fact finding are perfectly aligned. When you look at the video, you know, Mr. Christmas is pulled out of the car. The door is basically half open as the police approach. Police pull him out of the car, and the process of doing that to handcuff him, like it takes 5 seconds, it's one motion, and the process of doing that forces the door fully open, 90 degrees wide open, and at that point, and only at that point, does McConnell say, oh, there's a gun tucked, by the way, way back over by the transmission tunnel, okay? So the government says, who cares, it would have been seen anyway, he would have been ordered out of the car, maybe he's ordered out of the car, and he shuts the car door. Maybe, you know, he stands up, as he already had, and gets out of the car, and the car door's still half open. So Judge Mascot, you asked about sort of hypotheticals. That's actually what the government is arguing. They are arguing hypotheticals, and that's in the world of inevitable discovery. Yeah, okay, maybe there was a violation here. My friend says you don't have to reach that, and frankly, I agree. I think it's perfectly clear a violation. MIMS does not support this conduct. But even if there is no violation, inevitable discovery asks, well, would the gun have been found anyway? And that's kind of what the government in substance is saying, but they've never invoked that doctrine. And in fact, it doesn't apply because inevitable discovery has to be inevitable for all those reasons that I just mentioned. The government can't possibly show that. Door could have been closed. He could have stood up if he had been given proper MIMS order, et cetera.
But, you know, so this is the question that I asked your opposing counsel, which was, let's take ourselves out of but-for causation and let's just look at temporally. There has to be a Fourth Amendment violation before that door opens all of the way, right? Because that's and so in looking at the video, and you've characterized it as excessive force, I think. Is that right? Do you think that's a fair characterization? No,
that's not the words I used. I think that is not the best way to put it, just because it opens the door to this fallacy that I think the other side is arguing, that excessive force is just about 1983. It can't possibly be related. But whatever you call it, what I said was the removal, instead of being ordered out, MIMS permits step out of the car. It doesn't even have to be a question. It can be a command. But it's the physical removal, and in this case, it happened to be one and the same. It was a handcuffing. Like, literally, it was one motion. The officers, you know, as Your Honor saw on the video, pull up his hand, spin him around, pull out the cuffs.
But before the cuff went on, the door was open all the way.
That's correct. But it was the act, and whether you call it whether we focus on the MIMS, what I would say is the MIMS violation here, the sort of physical, the MIMS not authorized physical extraction of Mr. Christmas, or we think about it as this was a handcuffing. This was the first step in the handcuffing. I don't think it matters, because what's clear under this court's cases is that, you know, you cannot handcuff someone in a typical car stop absent, you know, reasonable suspicion of being armed and dangerous or dangerous in general. And of course, the government's conceded that there was no reasonable suspicion of that.
Are you arguing that the police, in essence, put themselves in a position that they were not authorized to be in and therefore saw the gun?
Yes. And here it happens to be because what they did was when they pulled him out, you can focus on, you know, the pulling out or call it a handcuffing, whichever. It's 3 seconds in the video. It's one event. That opened the door. You know, factual causation, the government's up here arguing but for cause.
And Mr. Zasmer's also arguing that they were authorized to remove him for the
audience. Okay, well, the briefing, the briefing says it's arguable and you don't really have to reach in. And I think Mr. Zasmer said that here today too, but let's talk about that. And there's absolutely no authority there's no case law that they can cite saying it's okay to immediately upon a traffic stop go pull someone out of a car.
Well,
touching an extraction.
Let me just tease that out. I mean, there's a tendency to read MIMS is the ceiling, right? Like the most you can do is MIMS, right? But MIMS wasn't written as a ceiling case. MIMS was written as kind of your standard, ordinary case. This is what we view as a minimal infraction. It uses the word minimal multiple times. And so from using the minimal part, it then goes, but I don't know that it should be read as a ceiling. And at least as I saw the video, I saw reasons for the officers to think that it might be permissible to exceed what MIMS does, because MIMS isn't a ceiling case. And that is, you have a person who's exhibiting erratic behavior, very predictable erratic behavior. And then once the car stops, that erratic behavior continues. This kind of opening, I mean, very, you know, it's a very unusual thing to kind of open the door halfway and do what he did. So we aren't on this kind of just, you know, nice standard traffic stop. You're going so much over, you know, license and registration, please. This is different. It was erratic beforehand and it was unusual afterwards. Doesn't that mean if we don't view MIMS as a ceiling, that there would be reasons kind of grounded in reasonableness to let the officers do something largely non-forceful to remove a person from the car in the name of safety?
Sure. Two things, Your Honor. First, respectfully, that's actually off the table for this court. And the reason why is not only is there fact finding below, and this is it, appendix 22, 20, basically 20 to 24, where the district court says they're looking at the video, hearing the testimony, district court says there's no evasive behavior, this was not flight, this was not anything that could reasonably give rise to a danger.
And all of that was made based on the district court's review of the video, right?
Yes, but, and here's the clincher. Now the government comes in and says they basically buck the fact finding on causation. But importantly, and this is the difference, they don't even challenge that fact finding on appeal. So those facts are no longer on the table for this court. That's a party presentation problem. They could have argued, one of the holdings of the district court was that there was no justification for a vehicle frisk. And the government did not appeal that. So all of those facts Your Honor just mentioned, they go to that issue, and so it's sort of double deference owed. It's not only, you know, not clear error, it's district fact finding, but it's no longer on the table because that's not appealed.
Okay, I know you want to get your point. Can I just pivot on what, but it's related. Where are you on the applicability of plain error for their but-for causation point? Because they say, we got surprised, so we can't be held to, you know, the obligation to present in front of the district court. Do you agree with that or do you disagree with that?
Well, I disagree with it. And let me just a point of clarification. It's not plain error. We're in suppression land, so these are forfeited things that cannot be reached by the court. You know,
so closer to waiver.
Well, the court is... Yeah. Coming back and forth, waiver, forfeiture.
I know.
But regardless, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, unlike plain error where you go to the prongs, is it clearer and we still reach it, that doesn't apply here. So if it wasn't raised below, it's not reachable here. So the government didn't bring this up, and that's true. But I think more, and the court could certainly rule on that basis, and I argue it in my brief, I think the strongest waiver point or the most obvious, the most egregious waiver here, really the government, the strain of the government's argument saying that the district court sort of went off on its own, this idea that we forfeited this and the district court suppressed evidence on a ground that was never raised by the district court. They had the district court's opinion, you know, before this appeal ever was filed. In their opening brief, if they wanted to make a party presentation rule, district court went off on a tangent rule argument. Defendant didn't make this argument below. If they wanted to make those arguments, the time to do it was in the blue brief, not, you know, in the reply brief when, you know, as Mr. Zalzmer candidly mentioned, the opinion came clear to them. So that's, I think, personally, I think that's where waiver has the most bite here in this case. But regardless, yes, you know, appellants all the time have to raise their suppression issues below. And here the government put all their eggs in the Fourth Amendment violation basket, did not argue as a backup argument that there was no causation, and now they've changed their tune on appeal. If your honors have no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your Honor, I take strong exception to my friend Mr. Schweitzer's statement that the argument was made clearly by the defendant in the district court and that the government has waived anything in any way. He cites page 82 of the appendix. I know you'll look at it. It is not there. What's happening at page 82 of the appendix and the pages around it is all part of this reasonable suspicion argument. There are words there where they talk about what could the officers see or not see. But it's all in the context of this stop shouldn't have happened. He should not be taken out of the car. And then also on page 82, the counsel goes into his further argument that you couldn't see the gun unless you went into the car and leaned over, as the officer later did with his camera. If you read the district court opinion and what it says, which is that by forcibly removing him from the car, they saw the gun, and compare that to the arguments made by the defendant both in their written pleadings and in the hearing, you will not see it. And that's the reason that the government did not present it. As far as could we have argued here party presentation, could we argue that the district court's opinion should be rejected outright because the district court came up with this argument on its own? To be frank with the court, of course, we thought about that, but we thought that this is just such a clear error by the district court on the merits that that's how we would approach it, knowing that so many arguments were thrown around by the parties in the district court, that this was the clear way to present it, and it's the way we offer it to the court today. Getting to the question of taking him from the car, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, as we're told over and over, is reasonableness. And so, of course, as Judge Phipps perhaps suggests, Mims cannot be the ceiling. You have to look at each case individually and see, did the police act reasonably? This, if we got to the issue, if it did have to be resolved here, of course this was reasonable conduct. The officer carefully went up to him. He had been acting erratically, gently pulled him up, and then there was a little bit of a scuffle. So now it's Mr. Schweitzer who's coming up with new hypotheticals of, well, maybe he could have closed the door. The fact is, they were going to take him out of the car. The door had to be open to do that. McConnell is standing right there with his camera and sees the gun at that time. And that's what happened here. One other point I'd like to make, he says we didn't challenge the district court's ruling regarding the defendant's nervousness. That was in a specific context. The government made an argument in the district court that there was reasonable suspicion to do a Terry frisk based on the suspicion that he would be armed and dangerous. The government included in that the fact that he was nervous, he was erratic, the way he had behaved. That was what the district court denied. That's what we have not appealed. But there's certainly no clear finding that this gentleman was acting appropriately, and nor is there any contradiction of the important thing, which is that the officers expressed their concern. McConnell said, we were concerned. That's why Rosenbaum did exactly what he did. Bottom line, he was getting out of the car. They took him out of the car, whether they'd asked him or not asked him. That's what was going to happen. The gun was then visible. And as a result, this gun should be admitted under the plain view doctrine. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank counsel for the briefs and the arguments. And we'll circle